This is Sunday Nights.
And that spiritual affinity they have is part of the essential of their being.
Exploring religion, ethics and society.
But actually caring for people in need and poverty and hurt and all that stuff, it all binds together. It's not separated.
With John Cleary.
It's amazingly potent, the culture.
On ABC Local Radio.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us this Sunday night. It's a very special Sunday night. We're coming to you live from Midland in Perth, the home of one of my regular guests on Sunday night, Jared McKenna, but most importantly of two remarkable initiatives. The subject of this evening's Compass, if you happen to watch it on ABC television, the first home project, and Love Makes a Way. More on that shortly, but by way of introduction, let's just hear from the audience here on Sunday night at Midland, at the home of Love Makes a Way. We'd like you all to say hi to the audience around the world. And we hope you all feel at home here on Sunday night. Well, we're here tonight in Perth, and I've got to say, this is a beautiful example of a river in the wasteland. We're here at Midland by the house that has made Love Makes a Way and the First Home Project, surrounded by a stream that meanders down to become part of the Great Swan River, and cushioned by a grove of gum trees. A beautiful place to be. Let's know you're here, folks. So let's talk about why we're here. Love Makes a Way is one response to the continuing detention of asylum seekers and refugee children in Australia. The program reached national attention when in a series of planned actions, Christian clergy and others from across a number of denominations selected the offices of key federal government ministers, including Julie Bishop, for a sit-in occupation and prayer vigil. The resulting arrest and, in one incident, the strip searching of female clergy made headlines around the country. The First Home Project, which is the centrepiece of this site, started when Jared and Teresa wished to obtain a mortgage on a large house in order to provide a secure base for refugee families seeking to establish themselves in Australia. The banks refused, so Jared and Teresa set up a crowdfunding initiative with friends, gaining the support of both World Vision's Tim Costello and Melbourne's irascible Father Bob. And so to our guests this evening. The team from Love Makes a Way and the First Home Project, it's a pleasure to welcome Jared, Teresa, Marshid and Alex. Welcome to you all.
Thanks
for joining us on Sunday night. Alex, I've got to ask you. You weren't a part of the Compass program that many people may have seen around Australia, but you've been a significant player in Love Makes a Way. Looked to me like a lovely suburban girl. How did you feel when somebody said, "I'm arresting you"?
Oh, John, one word comes to mind, surreal. It was just a surreal experience, yeah. I think just getting in that van, they had those nice little paddy wagons rather than the nice sedans for us, so just to make it a little bit more uncomfortable, but being in there was, yeah, a really surreal experience, yeah.
Therese, you were fairly shaken by the experience. Those who saw the Compass program earlier this evening may got your reaction, but for the many in the audience who didn't see that program, what was it like for you? What was going through your mind? You're thinking, hang on, I started this, where is it headed?
We were actually warned before we went to the police station that if we did not leave the premises, so the offence is technically trespass, so if we didn't leave the premises, then we would be strip searched. So we were aware before then. So the people that were in that office that day made that decision beforehand, risking knowing that that would actually happen. Now, we had got advice from a lawyer before we went in, and we were told that They would need to provide reasonable grounds that they had suspicion that we were holding weapons or drugs. And so I wouldn't say naively, I genuinely believed that the law exists to protect me. So I fully expected when I turned up to the police station that I would be able to have a reasonable conversation with the sergeant there, and they would explain to me on what grounds they felt it was necessary to strip search us. Of course, none of this took place.
So you felt that in some way, even though you were acting knowingly violating the law, you were still within the boundaries that would, on reasonable behaviour, led to you just being arrested, and an assurance that you weren't carrying drugs or weapons would be sufficient for you to be just arrested and processed as you had been on a previous occasion.
Absolutely. We'd spent 9 hours praying together in a politician's office.
So what do you think the motivation of the police was in the strip search?
That's a tricky question.
Well, perhaps,
go
on.
You would ask me my gut intuition response, we've lodged a formal complaint to have it investigated, but my gut response is that the legislation that exists, which means that they have the power to do it, in the legislation there's one word that says if you are in custody, the police officer may strip search you for weapons and drugs if you're in custody. So that one word may, I tell you what, I thought about that word may for the entire day. So because of that, there is discretion that they could apply, and that was not applied in that circumstance.
Jared, do you think that that was part of a decision to perhaps use the law in a way that was intimidatory? That is, look, let's push this one step further so they won't do it again.
John, I don't really go for conspiracy theories, but the Australian Human Rights Law Centre has said that it seems to be a gross abuse of police powers to deliberately intimidate protesters. So that's their professional take. Amateur like me, who has a number of mates, like Sunili, who's here tonight with a humanitarian group, talking to those kind of friends, incredible lawyers, about the work that they do, it seems pretty clear to a number of them that this is out of the ordinary. But in saying that, this actually isn't out of the ordinary for Western Australia. We have some of the most draconian laws, and usually it's people that others don't pay attention to that are on the receiving end. We're talking Mr. Ward, who died in the back of a paddy wagon, talking about Miss Doo, who also died in police custody. Because these are Aboriginal people, unfortunately, it doesn't get the same headlines as when, white, middle-class, straight, suburban priests and pastors experience something along the same lines.
Alex, let me ask you. You're a member of a local church congregation.
That's right.
What was the response in members of your congregation, your local church or your local suburban shopping centre, for that matter, when here's somebody we know and like and has been arrested for doing something dreadfully, it's just unseemly, really, sort of sitting in a minister's office. It's just a bit too political.
Most people's reaction was just that can't be right. My senior minister used to be a police officer, and when he was actually first told about it, he said, "No, that's wrong. That didn't happen." And so he actually just couldn't believe that that had actually happened to us. And that was generally the reaction of all my family and friends, was absolute disbelief and why on earth would anyone have why would anyone do that?
When you explained, was there still a sense of, well, you might be doing a right thing, but we don't think it's the right way to do it?
Before the strip search?
With the church congregation, just the fact of you being arrested. I mean, did people feel that that's just not the way to go about such protests?
Oh, look, we've got quite a diverse congregation, and I think for the most part people have been incredibly supportive, and it's a little bit shocking perhaps, or a little bit surprising, that level of protest. But I think at the same time people get that the issue that we've been looking at and wanting to take action on, and they understand that all the other things are not working, so what else can we do to bring that to a new level of awareness?
The primary issue, yes, Therese.
The reality is we should never, ever have had to sit in the politician's office. It is because It's because these policies exist, mm-hmm. and children are being detained, and we've tried all kinds of avenues to be able to articulate that, and nobody is listening. Mm. So the strategy was about going, we're going to sit here and we're going to continue sitting here until you actually respond, when will these children be released from detention?
The key issue, that is children in detention, minors in detention, children who are very, very young, suffering psychological damage, according to most professionals in the field, has now led to a position where most of them, or many of the children, have now been released. Jared, do you think you made the slightest difference to the way the politicians behaved, or were they going to really do it anyway? I'm sure you get that response from people.
As people are aware, I'm a huge student of Martin Luther King, and one of the things that King insisted on is being gracious in the victory, and you actually give an opportunity for those who change their mind to come over to the winning side. He called it a double victory. Not only will we win our case, but we'll win you in the process. And it's important to say, just like segregated lunch counters, if you had asked them in the 1960s, is this the only segregation that bothers you, they would say, no, of course not. This is the one that's winnable now. If you ask me, am I okay with adults in indefinite detention? These are like human beings with stories that survived the most horrific things, and we're locking them up indefinitely, their future's frozen, and they've committed no crimes. I was out at Acacia Prison visiting and watching a play, actually, last week. Those guys know when their time is up, and they also know what they've done. John, we're talking about human beings who have committed no crime. What they've done is they've simply sought safety. And at the moment, irrationally, our nation is actually responding by locking these people up. So if you were to ask me, like, now that we're down to, 150 or so children, is that enough? No way. Like, I'm going to be at this until, you know, the kingdom comes. And I use those words deliberately.
You've already mentioned the other aspect by implication of what you've been doing, and that is the First Home Project, that is providing a base from which refugees can be brought in to a more secure environment in Australia. And we have one person here who's been part of that. And before we introduce Masheed, Therese, you've got something to say about the First Home Project.
If I can, John, I'd like to just step back a little bit.
Yeah?
Because I just can't let this opportunity go. With the number of people that are listening, the reality is that we have still got children detained on Nauru. Like, that cannot be overlooked. Yes, what has been achieved so far through the collective, so many different actions that have happened, so many different Australians have stepped up and said, not just Love Makes Way, so many different movements have said, this is not okay. So I can't. 95. Yeah, so 95 children we currently have. We cannot overlook that fact. They are still there, and those children cannot be invisible.
And, John, it's also really important to say that this isn't the home of Love Makes a Way. Or if it is, this is one of many homes in every major city and a whole bunch of towns. That there are over 200 Christians that have now participated in Love Makes a Way. And we were just like early to the party, as a bunch of people in Sydney were as well. So what we're seeing here is just actually a sign of, if you look out at this crowd and the way that people support everything that happens here, there's a whole bunch of Australians who are tonight celebrating that Reclaim Australia was a top trending topic, and Love Makes a Way has knocked it off, and Love Makes a Way is now a top trending topic. And that's the kind of Australia we want to see.
We've got government ministers, before we leave this topic, Therese, just picking up your point, we've got a bipartisan consensus on the way this issue should be handled, and it seems that that bipartisan political consensus in Canberra still secures the majority support of most Australians, those who don't come in contact with the realities of it. Is that something of a frustration to you? Like, speaking in your church, Alex, just locally, you must know other congregations, if you go to them, they'd say, well, look, I sort of support what the government's doing because we've really got a major problem on our hands here.
Absolutely, John. I still feel that the Christian community are as a whole, the Christian community are amazing at getting around issues and doing the rescue and looking after the weak, looking after the poor, etc. But I feel that especially the Perth Christian community, and I think it's probably the same in all of our capital cities, what we're not very good at just yet is we don't like to be political. And sometimes those terms political and actually just looking, standing up for justice can get a little bit skewed, and we almost feel like we don't want to be on the front foot with something. We're happy to clean up the messes behind, but we don't want to get on the front foot and actually, you know, and stand up there where it is a bit risky and, you know, we could offend somebody.
Because if you stand at the top of the cliff, you could get knocked off.
Mm. Yes. And John, what we're talking about is the politics of what's happening right here. We're not talking about party politics. Mm. No one here is advocating that, like, we saddle up to any particular political party on any side. Mm. We're talking about the politics of community. You look at this beautiful crowd and what's happening here. This is the politics of compassion in action, embodying a real alternative. And Australia needs to see things like this, to see that, like, these people, like, while they're kept, like, offshore, and we can demonise them as monsters and think of them as like these, and when you hear people's stories and we suddenly realise that these are people like you and me, only they need safety, everything changes. That's the kind of politics we're talking about, the politics of compassion.
Mashid, you've come to Australia. Let's introduce you to our audience. Tell us a little of your story, how you came to Australia, how you came to be here.
Actually, I came to Australia about 2.5 years ago, and I first met Teresa at her birthday party. My auntie, she's friend with Teresa, and I got to know her and her beautiful family through my auntie, and our friendship started since then. And I came to Australia with my family, suffering from torture and trauma.
Where did you come from?
I came from Iran, and because my family were involved with political action against the government, we had to leave the country and come to Australia. We've been, you know, since I know Teresa and things that she's doing, in just one word, I can say she's amazing, and okay. Teresa and Jared, they're just amazing, and the job that they're doing, it's just amazing.
And you found a way to be involved as well. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
Since I came here, as you know, being in a community with unbridging visa, it's something that not everyone likes to have. Mm. Not having right to work, not having so many rights. You are just living in a community, and you don't have, like, you don't have any rights. You're just living, and so I just started to look for things that can help me to get involved with the community, like volunteer works, and look for something to do. So I've been involved with different volunteer positions, and I've been studying a little bit, which...
You're a bit shy on that. Tell us just exactly what you've now reached in study. What, like, are you about to do?
Like the scholarship.
Teresa has recently helped me a lot with my scholarship application, which was the opportunity that I got. It was made through the Human Rights Center at Curtin University. They gave bridging visa people, they gave this opportunity to them to apply for a degree at Curtin University, which was something really unexpected for me. And I still cannot believe that it has happened. And she's been really amazing. She helped me a lot with my application.
You're at Sunday Night Under the Stars here at Midland in Perth, at the home of the First Home Project. And Mashid has just been giving us a little insight into that. Teresa, you tell us how this house came to be.
I think, I mean, the snapshot of it was definitely in the story, but it was just this, like, I mean, Jared and I were renting. We had most people who know us from the kind of the activist world were like, Teresa and Jared are trying to buy a house. And we had no intention at all of getting a mortgage. But it was just like, We're renting. There's no way we can accommodate more people than what we currently have in our house. The only way that we can is if we actually become landlords, which is what I said. So we're like, okay, right, how do we become landlords?
And join then the ruling class.
it was just kind of this practical, like, okay, right, we are blessed to have grown up in this country. We have the education to be able to go to university. We had good jobs, so we could get a mortgage. So it's like, okay, why not try and get a mortgage and try and find a house that was big enough to be able to accommodate as many people as we could.
And the rationale behind that was?
The rationale behind it was is that if you were coming, if you're new to Australia, you have to have, to be able to rent a property, you have to have a rental history. You have to be able to demonstrate that you've got sufficient income, of which those two things are actually not possible when you first arrive. So, yeah, in particular, I mentioned at the time, because of the degree of homelessness was happening at the time, obviously we're very, very concerned about people who've just literally, you know, come into our country highly traumatized and needing safety, needing stability. And that comes, everyone wants a home.
And the first version of this was, I believe at one stage, a crack house or something like that. And it has been recovered, a meth lab. I'm sorry, I stand corrected. I'm not too clear on the
drugs.
Sort of problem state of drugs. And it's now been converted into three units. Jared and Therese occupy the centre unit, and on either side, families come and stay for as long as they need to stay.
And it's important pointing out as well, like incredible guys like Alan McGreshan, who's been here serving. When the house next door came up, he bought it, and now another house hold of newly arrived people are living there. And then John and Nina felt a call to come down, and they're renting the place across the road and have had a young Hazara guy staying with their family. So in terms of what they're demonstrating to their little boys, who are both toddlers, of like, this is what hospitality is, this is what our faith looks like, suddenly we've found that in the neighbourhood there's this network of people. And then we've got friends like Kate Leaney from Welcome to Australia and Nathan at Middlemass, and we've got Miles, who have all moved in so they can volunteer here on a regular basis as well. So it's, we're taking over Midland with compassion. It's beautiful.
And you've preserved this sacred grove in the midst of Midland. And we're here in the middle of the sacred grove in Midland this evening with a great crowd. And in a moment, folks, it's going to be your turn to participate. If you've got observations you'd like to make about the way things have operated around here, how you think it works, what you think the good things are, the bad things, how you think the local church community has responded, how you think the broader community needs to respond to these sorts of ideas, you get your chance. We'll have two microphones out for you to sort of get ready to ask your questions. You stick your hand up. When the microphone comes to you, you just give your name and say, I'm so-and-so. I'd like to make a comment, or I'd like to ask one of the panellists here, because you know this panel far better than I do. There may be some questions that need to be just probed a little bit from your perspective here. One other thing with the First Home Project, the most difficult things seem to be in some ways things that the rest of society thinks are so ordinary. Just the capacity for a new family to establish a credit record. That has been something that has required the sort of effort you've put in to establish this home. Most Australians don't recognise those hurdles, Jared.
Yeah, like I said in the doco that I think's up on iView now, these people are phenomenal. They don't want handouts. This isn't about charity. This is about community. That what they actually need is like a hand up. They just need an even playing field. These people come with degrees. I'm the dumb Australian that only speaks one language, John. They come speaking two or three or four. We've got friends who speak seven languages. All they need is safety. And people sometimes assume, well, I guess they're poor then. Not necessarily. Einstein wasn't poor when he went to the US as a refugee. He was a Jew in Germany. That's how refugees work. What you need is actual safety. And so what we're able to provide is what we would want somebody to do unto us if we were in the same situation. You know, it's Christianity 101, not optional extra kind of stuff, just doing to others, regardless of faith, regardless of orientation, regardless of political persuasion, what we would want them to do to us.
You're showing a sort of Christian activism which people might associate, say, with the civil rights movement in the United States in the 1960s, or if you go back 100 years before that, the anti-slavery movement. But that's a tradition that sits very sort of uncomfortably at the edges of most Christian communities. Most Christian communities are used to sort of turning up for worship on Sunday. If you like, you watch the preacher and say, bless me if you can, and then, you know, you sort of leave afterwards. It's not the sort of Christianity that sits well in the suburbs all the time.
Our local church is in the suburbs, and there's a whole heap of people. Riverview is here as well. We've got West City, we've got Riverview. There's people from churches, right? I think we'd actually be surprised that I think this is actually maybe not what catches the headlines, because it's usually the sensational, like, horrific stuff that does. But I actually think this is bread and butter, just kind of Christianity happening on the quiet, putting love in action, rolling up your sleeves and living God's love. I actually think that's what's happening right across Australia.
Anybody that was in my office on Wednesday when I read the blurb under Compass that said Jared and Teresa, Christian activists, I was incensed. I ran into Alex's office. Alex is also my boss, by the way, and she is incredible, incredible. But I ran into office, I'm like, I'm so mad. And she's like, why? I was like, I'm not an activist. This is what it means to follow Jesus. That's
Amen.
It.
Amen.
All right, time, folks, for you to express your opinion on the opinions that have been here. We've got two microphones. Stick your hand up. I can see hands up all over the place already. We're going to have some running disciples this evening with the microphones. Just say who you are and make a comment. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Dawood. I just want to ask that, don't you guys think that history will blame us being so cruel against, like, refugees and asylum seekers?
How do you think history will treat us? The lessons of history are pretty clear, are they not? Jared, you've spent a little time studying history and theology. It's part of what made you take the course you have.
Yeah, Dawood, so much so. And knowing your particular story and what you've survived and what your family are going through currently, I want to ask you forgiveness that we as Australia haven't responded better. But I want to also give you my word that we're doing everything we can so that you won't be shot at again and your family members won't go through what they went through last week, and that we can be a country that we're actually proud of.
You need to open that up for us a little, Jared, last week.
Dawood lost family members who were killed. Family members that he hoped would have found safety here.
And whereabouts?
They're Hazaras who are trying to find a safe place in Pakistan, but they're actually initially from Afghanistan.
Mm. The Hazara community has suffered particularly in the recent years of refugee crisis, and we need to be aware of that. The particular groups are suffering disproportionately all around the world. It's a difficult one for the UN, and a topic we might touch on later in the evening on Sunday night, when the UN is saying, look, we can be non-discriminatory, we have to be non-discriminatory, yet we know the particular groups are suffering more than other groups. It's very difficult to know what to do on that one. That's a topic for later on. For right now, there's other hands up around the arc of the sky. Who's going to be next? Give us your name, tell us your question.
Sorry, my name's Tim. Jared and Teresa, I really want to commend the clarity with which you link your work to the long history of nonviolent resistance to injustice. And my question is, how do you see the pathway towards your attitudes and activism becoming more mainstream, more accepted by the mainstream? What is the pathway for that happening?
$64,000 question.
I think this is it, Tim. Like, seriously, it's you as a drama teacher hanging out and realising that despite my lack of haircut, that this actually isn't all that radical is just love in action. And the more that we actually learn what's actually happening, I think people are compassionate. It's putting that compassion in action. So I think it's the conversations you're going to make tonight, and as you ask yourselves, given my history, given what I've been blessed with, what am I willing to risk for the freedom of someone else? And we're happy to sign people up for more trainings tonight.
Alex, you're somebody who, as we said, even though you're Teresa's boss, you work in an ordinary suburb, you live with an ordinary church congregation. How do you see this, the sort of energy here spreading out through other churches and congregations?
I see incredible leadership needed, and I thank Jared and Teresa for the leadership that they've shown in this area. Jared is a pretty out there guy, but I've learned so much from the way these guys work on, in sometimes, you know, that push is needed to see others, you know, actually get what this is all about. But yeah, I also just think that on the whole, Jared, I understand what you're saying, you know, it's already happening here, but I also believe that within the Christian community, that each one of us really have to make an effort to go, what else can I do and how else can I respond to this issue and get out of our comfort zones and actually like lead ourselves in this whole area. It has to be a real push for us.
And John, since we're doing thank yous, I want to mention the lead pastor at West City, Phil Stevenson, who I'm happy to serve under, and what he's created, that he would actually provide a place where this kind of leadership is encouraged. I love him, and that is really pioneering stuff, and I love him for it.
Another question.
My name's David. Question for you, Trevor. I noticed that you were teaching in the video before, you were teaching guys how to surf. As a particularly avid wave chaser myself, in my experience overseas, I've seen that surfing can actually be a big uniting force and can bring people quite a lot of happiness. So in your adventures teaching these guys the simple act of catching a wave, what are the changes you've seen in them?
Yeah, there was a fascinating study that just came out, David, about how people with post-traumatic stress disorder are being prescribed surfing as a form of therapy, which, that's amazing. If anybody is interested in connecting with First Surf Project, Talib, one of the founders who you saw in the video, is here tonight. But I also know that on the East Coast, for those who are listening nationally, there's groups like Surfers for Refugees that have started on the East Coast as well, and you can find out their details through Welcome to Australia. So if you surf, find the thing that you love, like whether it's surfing, and then do it with people who would love to be included, work on their English and enjoy that. So maybe we can go for a surf together, Dave.
Another question. Yeah, I see a thumbs up there from surfing colleagues. Another question, yes.
Hi, my name's Josh.
Josh!
Yes, hello.
Josh painted, slogged for weekends and weekends as a painter apprentice, renovating a house. Nice to see you, Josh.
Okay, I'm embarrassed now. Thank you.
Go for it, Josh.
So I was thinking actually about different refugee crises that have happened throughout history. Well, two have struck me most. After the Vietnam War, obviously there was lots of refugees from South Vietnam, and Australia actually went ahead and took on around 94,000 over 10 years. And most recently, after the really cowardly attacks on Paris, France is still taking on 30,000 refugees from Syria. What strikes me is that a lot of these attacks are coming from people who are disaffected or in communities that are kind of segregated. So would you agree that the greatest way to stop any sort of attacks from happening is to show love rather than hate?
Now, there's one for all of us to consider. How do we respond? Perhaps I could have a go here. I actually think that we ought to adopt, because groups like this, now there must be, 200 people here tonight? You're all, sort of, most of you are members of congregations. What about we start a sort of national Muslims adopt the church, Christians adopt the mosque campaign, and we can have everybody sharing with each other? Because I think it's only going to be at the grassroots, Jared, that these things... Mm. And Alex, it echoes what you said, just from church to church or church to mosque or whatever. Just
John, one of the things that I love about First Home Project is that it is actually about a community who fiercely wanted to respond and say, we want to be different. Mm. This is not the Australia we want to be. Mm. And no amount of government detention policy can destroy the love that does exist within community. This was a collaborative effort. Mm. First Home Project would not happen if people weren't willing to invest money into it, loan money to us, paint walls, come on a Friday night and just hang out with these amazing people who have just arrived. It's the community. Mm. And so I think somehow, and that's why I'm very grateful that you're doing this, John, we're hoping that more stories like this can get out there, because it projects like a mirror to the community to say, yeah, you can actually be different.
Is community a bounded group or an open group? And that's a bit of the sociologists argue about this from time to time. I mean, do we construct communities to build boundaries to make us all feel secure, or do we use them as open platforms in which to sort of welcome others into another way of life? That's a whole continuing discussion that, Jared, I'm sure you have preached on many times. There's a question here in the middle. I saw a hand up over here. We got one? There we go.
Hi, I'm Matt, and question for Jared and Teresa is, what has been, by and large, the response from the Christian community when you've approached them with this project? If you're a minister or just a congregation member, what would be like the first step if you wanted to get involved in something like this?
Yeah, great question, Matt. Did you want to take that, my love? Yeah. In terms of Love Makes a Way, the simplest thing is to go to the Facebook page, and you can actually click that you want to see every update and get a sense of what's coming out all the time. In terms of here, it's probably not appropriate for everybody to get involved here, but there are lots and lots of beautiful things right around Australia. There are probably people in your neighbourhood that you can meet. So we're not looking to franchise. There's already McDonald's. We don't need McKenna's. Thanks for laugh, Dave.
You've worked on that one.
Yeah. I've used that preaching before, John. What is it in your neighbourhood? And that's why we're so glad that we're going to take up a huge collection tonight, and none of the money is going to us. It's all going towards a humanitarian group. If you want to make a real difference and you've got money and not time, give to the humanitarian group or the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre if you're on the East Coast. Or there are so many groups doing phenomenal things. This is actually happening everywhere. If you're in Perth, we're on national radio, so maybe we can talk afterwards in terms of how people can get involved here. But I will say this in terms of our approaches, because we often get asked about our approach. We're not running teams. We're not initiating people as volunteers. We have a meal where people make friends, and if the friendship is genuine, you'll start to hear needs, and you'll realise that it's driving lessons, or it's homework help, or it's English lessons, or it's help shopping, and or it's help with managing a checkbook. And as you build that friendship, it's initiatives, and we see our friends, and we're like, hey, we didn't even know you're here. Oh, we've been here the last 4 hours. Why didn't you come and see us? Oh, because you're hanging out with our neighbours. I mean, that's a beautiful thing. And that's the kind of community that's actually been created here, because it's really not about us.
Mashid, what are the most important things for a new arrival when you come into a country and you know no one and you think, I don't understand the language, much less the culture. I don't even like the trees.
I think, yeah, I do. It's a beautiful country. It's a beautiful land. But I think language, as you mentioned, that's the most difficult part and the most important part that, you know, most of the people, I know, like, some people, you know, even those people who have a little bit of English, or even they can speak English, even those ones, like, I could speak English when I came here, but still I'm struggling. And I can imagine how hard would it be for those people who cannot understand even a word in English, and they have to do their, you know, their daily life. They have to start build up again everything, you know, going through everything that they should have done, like renting house, doing shopping, daily things that they were doing back in their country. So they have to build up everything again with no communication, without having, you know, a single word, and they have to, without having a single friend. So they have to start from the scratch and build up those things. So language is the most important thing.
The beauty of that, it seems to me, is being a partner in that is something that anybody can do.
Yeah.
You don't need particular skills, Therese.
I love that you went to the point around partnership, because that is absolutely what it is. The whole teaching around do unto others, the concept of that, if I was in a situation where I had to flee my country and I went to another country and I needed to somehow establish a new life, what would I need? I would hope that somebody would welcome me. I would hope that someone would help me teach the language. This is not about, it's not about charity. It's actually just the core basis of how do we remove the barriers when someone's having to create a new life, and how do we work together? Because these are incredibly resilient. There is so much that we can learn from these people that we lock out.
Syrian refugees that have arrived in Perth this week, some of them will come from Christian backgrounds. The group that arrived already have come from a Muslim background. This has to be a multi-faith as well as a multicultural reaching across the border as citizens. You're speaking from out of a particular religious community, a Christian community. But do you see this as a multi-faith enterprise?
I see this as a human enterprise. Like, I mean, a bunch of our friends who are here tonight have no faith at all and actually think that part of my life is kind of ridiculous, but they're just kind enough to hang out with me anyway. And this is about being human. I think in Jesus we see a vision of being human that is actually framed around compassion and this aggressive, non-violent love, if you want to frame it in Martin Luther King's terms.
You can speak about Mahatma Gandhi as easily as you can Martin Luther King Jr. in this context.
Totally. And in fact, King is very upfront that he, as a fourth-generation Baptist minister, didn't take Christian nonviolence seriously until he heard it from this Hindu Gandhi. And that's some of the richness that comes here. I mean, we live with more Muslims than we do Christians. Praise God. That's awesome. And it goes back to that kind of basic stuff. I think, as somebody who claims to follow Jesus, I have a responsibility to be on the forefront of fighting this Islamophobia that is creeping across the nation. And when Christians go for cheap shots where they denigrate another person's religion and scapegoat another person, there's nothing in that that looks like Jesus.
Anyone want to pick that one up? Yes, go.
Hello.
Hi.
My name's Daniel. You've picked up on the question I had, because my comment was, I'm a Christian. You guys are very openly Christian. And we've seen a lot of fear over particularly the last week or so, with some of the ugly stuff that's happening about talking about, well, we'll let Christians in, but we won't let people of other faiths in. I'd just love to hear even more on your personal experience of real people from other faiths, and whether you see that, how you just respond to that, because I think you've got some things to say and I'd like to hear.
I have the privilege of working for Riverview Church. The program that I work for, the program that we've developed, is looking at supporting people with their reading and writing component of applying for their visas. My team consists of predominantly Muslim people. I cannot tell you, sometimes it's quite terrible. Sometimes I'm on the verge of tears, because what I'm seeing is Muslim asylum seekers volunteering for my program saying, I want to serve other people in my community. I have the English literacy to be able to read and write and document this, and I want to do this, even though I don't know what my future is going to be. These are the people that we're talking about.
I'm not sure if anybody saw Stephen Colbert's response to the American discussion of only accepting Christian refugees, and there was a clip of Jeb Bush saying we should only accept, and the reporter said, how do we know that they're Christians? And he goes, we know. How do we know? You just know. And in response, Stephen Colbert was like, here's the test. I was naked and you clothed me. I was hungry and you fed me. Finish the rest of Jesus' quote. I was a stranger and you... And if you don't say welcome me, guess what? You're not a Christian. That's Colbert's response. The incredibly humbling thing about the Good Samaritan story is that it's not merely a story of enemy love. It's actually a story of the enemy is your model for neighbourly love. That here, like Jesus today in Australia, given this week, would tell the story of the good Muslim and hold them up as a model of actually not discriminating against somebody else, but reaching out to them.
Jared, I've got to come into this discussion there because one of our leading politicians, indeed our former Prime Minister, only last week, the week before, the Margaret Thatcher lecture delivered in Britain, implied that that model, that Jesus story model, the love thy neighbour model, is a metaphor, but you can't afford in situations that involve multinational migration, transmigration over national borders, that something like that should apply because this way lies chaos.
Yeah, I mean, John, it's no surprise to anybody here. My take is Jesus is Lord. So others might write him off as unrealistic. Others might write him off as naive. I actually think this love your neighbour stuff isn't an optional extra. So I don't have that luxury.
Who is my neighbour?
Apparently everyone. Awkward, isn't it?
Another question.
Hello, I'm Jo.
Hi, Jo. What would you like
Senator Jo Valentine, everyone.
Former, another life, past. I really want to commend Jared and Teresa for both Love Makes a Way and the First Home Project. Really inspiring work. Just fantastic. Thank you. And what you've just been saying leads to the question that's been on my mind. I mean, what we're experiencing now is just a test run for the future. I mean, we ain't seen nothing yet.
Yep.
Climate change.
Yep.
Let's bring that into it. We have millions of displaced people around the world at the moment, millions of people seeking a safe place to live. And I love the way you use expressions like the politics of compassion. Of course, that's what we need desperately. But we are going to be facing many, many, many more people fleeing, and we are going to have to learn to share, be less selfish. So what we're experiencing now, I just see as a test run. We're not doing fabulously at it, you know, with some outstanding exceptions, of course, of which this is one. But, you know, what would you, any of you, like to offer in terms of projecting a little bit further into the future about what is to come?
Former Senator Jo Valentine has just set up a whole other discussion. And I've got to tell you, we've run out of time. We've got about 30 seconds left live to air around the nation and around the world. I'd like to thank our panel, and I'd like you to thank our panellists. I'd like you to thank Jared, Teresa, Mashid and Alex for their contributions. Been wonderful to have you. And I think there's got to be a really big thank you to all of you. And coming up on Sunday night, we're going to hear from the G20 about what's been going on there. And we're also going to hear a little more about climate change on Sunday night.